They didn't announce it in a press conference. There was no State Department briefing, no formal policy rollback, no diplomatic statement carefully worded to soften 64 years of economic siege. On the 31st of March, 2026, a Russian oil tanker slid quietly into Cuban waters. And hours before it crossed the line, President Trump told reporters that he had, quote, no problem with it. That was all. No problem. 64 years of the most sustained economic embargo in modern history. 14 American presidents, two generations of Cubans who grew up ration counting, power outage enduring, choosing between medicine and cooking oil. And this administration, which has spent the last year tightening the blockade, cutting off Venezuelan oil shipments, sanctioning third-party tankers, watching Havana go dark for 20 hours at a stretch, simply step back and let Moscow's tanker through. This is not a story about one ship. It is a story about how the Caribbean has always been a chessboard, and how the people who live on it have always had to survive the moves they didn't make. To understand what happened this week, you have to go back further than most headlines will take you. Not just to 1962, when John F. Kennedy signed the formal embargo after the Bay of Pigs failure and the Cuban Missile Crisis transformed Caribbean waters into a Cold War theater. You have to go back to before independence, to the moment the Caribbean was first mapped, not as a home, but as a supply chain, when Spain, Britain, France, and the Netherlands established colonies across these islands. They were not building civilizations. They were building extraction machines. Sugar moved out. Labor moved in. Forced. Chained. Systematically destroyed. When slavery ended and the former colonial period collapsed, the extraction didn't stop. It adapted. Trade agreements. Military bases. Debt instruments. The Caribbean became dependent on outside powers, not because Caribbean people lacked ingenuity, but because every structural choice made by colonizers for two centuries was designed to prevent self-sufficiency. Cuba, by the mid-20th century, was a spectacular example of that trap. Before the revolution, the Cuban economy was effectively owned by American corporations and organized crime networks. 40% of sugar production, 90% of telephone and electrical utilities, 80% of public service railways. The mafia ran Havana's hotels. American fruit companies ran the ports. When Fidel Castro came to power in 1959 and began nationalizing those assets, Washington's response was swift, and it was the same response every Caribbean government had faced when it tried to reclaim its own resources. Punishment. The embargo of 1962 was framed as a response to communism. But communism was the ideology, not the offense. The offense was refusing to remain a supply chain. The offense was nationalizing American assets. The offense was saying that Cuban resources, Cuban sugar, Cuban oil terminals, Cuban labor belonged to Cubans. That is what Washington has never forgiven in Cuba or anywhere else in the Caribbean where a government has tried to make that same claim. The Soviet Union stepped in immediately. Moscow began supplying Cuba with oil, machinery, food subsidies, and military equipment. Between 1960 and 1991, the Soviet bloc supplied roughly 90% of Cuba's fuel needs. Cuba became economically dependent on Moscow, the way it had once been economically dependent on Washington. The geography changed. The dependency did not. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, and Cuba went through what it calls the special period, a five-year economic catastrophe between 1991 and 1996 that wiped out nearly 40% of Cuba's GDP. Cubans lost on average 20 pounds in body weight. Bicycles replaced cars. Oxen replaced tractors. The blackouts that lasted hours in the 1960s became blackouts that lasted days. Children learned to study by daylight because there was no reliable electricity after dark. Surgeons rescheduled operations based on the power schedule, not the patient's condition. Cuba survived. It did so through agricultural self-sufficiency experiments, medical tourism, remittances from the Cuban diaspora in Miami, and eventually a new alliance with Venezuela.
In 2004, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro formalized Petrocaribe, the oil alliance that would reshape Caribbean energy politics for the next decade. Venezuela supplied Cuba with subsidized oil in exchange for Cuban medical personnel and technical expertise.
It was, in Caribbean terms, a revolutionary arrangement, a regional solution that cut Washington out entirely. For a decade, it worked. Cuban hospitals ran on Venezuelan crude.
Venezuelan communities ran on Cuban doctors. Then Venezuela collapsed too.
The Maduro years brought hyperinflation, food shortages, mass immigration, and the slow disintegration of the Petro-Caribe arrangement. By 2023, Venezuelan oil deliveries to Cuba had fallen by nearly 70%. Cuba's grid began failing again. By 2025, Cuban families were experiencing rolling power cuts of 18 to 22 hours per day. Babies in hospitals were being delivered by flashlight. Surgeries were being postponed. 11 million people were living in near-permanent darkness.
And this is where 2026 finds Cuba. Exhausted, indebted, medically compromised, diplomatically isolated. And watching a Trump administration that had spent the last year tightening the pressure, sanctioning tankers, threatening secondary sanctions on countries that trade with Havana, cutting off remittance pathways, suddenly step back and say, no problem, let Moscow ship through. Why?
The answer begins with Iran. In the weeks before the tanker crossed into Cuban waters, the United States and Iran had entered into what sources described to the New York Times as productive preliminary negotiations over the ongoing military conflict in the Gulf. Allowing Russia to resupply Cuba served as a signal, a message to Moscow, that Washington was willing to trade concessions in America's near abroad in exchange for Russian pressure on Iran's government to move toward a ceasefire. This is how the Caribbean has always worked. It is not managed as a region of people with needs and histories and aspirations. It is managed as leverage, as a chessboard piece to be moved when the great powers need to communicate something to each other. Cuba gets fuel this week, not because the embargo was wrong, though it was and is, and not because Washington has changed its assessment of Cuban governance. Cuba gets fuel this week because it is useful at this moment for Moscow and Washington to send each other a signal through Caribbean waters. Caribbean people have understood this dynamic for centuries. The language changes, trade routes, Cold War spheres, counter-narcotics operations, fuel blockades, but the underlying structure does not. The Caribbean has resources, geography, and strategic location that the great powers want access to and want denied to each other.
The people who live in the Caribbean are almost incidental to that calculation. The Kalinago people of the Eastern Caribbean understood the Spanish this way. The Maroon communities of Jamaica understood the British this way. The Haitian revolutionaries of 1791 understood both.
Every generation of Caribbean people has had to find their survival within a geopolitical structure built by and for people who were never from these islands.
What has changed? What is slowly and unevenly changing is that Caribbean nations are beginning to build regional institutions that create some insulation from that dynamic. CARICOM, the Caribbean community, has grown from a trade bloc into a platform for coordinated foreign policy. When the United States announced its boat strike campaign in Caribbean waters, killing at least 163 people in strikes framed as counter-narcotics operations, CARICOM issued its most formal joint condemnation in the community's history.
When the United Nations voted to recognize transatlantic slavery as the gravest crime against humanity, every CARICOM nation voted in favor. These are small movements in a very long game. The Russian tanker will deliver its oil. Cuba's lights will come back on for a while.
And then some other great power calculation will shift the arrangement again, and the Caribbean will adapt to whatever new pressure emerges. But the question that this tanker raises, the question that hangs over Caribbean sovereignty like weather, is whether the region will ever be permitted to escape the dependency structure entirely. Whether Caribbean nations will be allowed to develop energy infrastructure that belongs to them, solar grids, wind farms, geothermal energy from the volcanic chain of the Eastern Caribbean, whether the same international financial institutions that have spent decades lending Caribbean governments money at premium rates to rebuild after hurricanes, events that are themselves the consequence of industrial emissions generated primarily by the global north, will ever be persuaded to invest in Caribbean energy independence rather than Caribbean energy dependency.
That is the argument that Caribbean scholars and policymakers have been making for 40 years. What the Russian tanker reveals is that the argument hasn't been won yet. Cuba is still dependent on whoever is willing to accept the political cost of supplying it.
The Caribbean region is still watching its waters used as diplomatic signal-sending channels between Moscow and Washington. And 11 million Cubans are still waiting to see if this week's quiet permission means their lights will stay on through the summer. Was this a strategic thaw? or a temporary convenience that will be revoked the moment Iran's negotiations shift course? And at what point does Caribbean survival stop being something that must be negotiated with distant great powers and start being something that Caribbean people build for themselves?